I now have a mic on each lapel. I feel all wired up. Thank you so much, Sirpa, for your wonderful invitation, and thank you to all of the organizing team to make this visit possible and to put together such an exciting conference. I'm really looking forward to hearing papers and having discussions with you today and tomorrow. So the paper is titled Affective Sovereignties, Mobility, Emplacement, and Translation in a Transnational World. Along with my collaborator, Akhil Gupta, I'm just completing long-term ethnographic research on how affective labor in the business process outsourcing or BPO industry in Bangalore shapes discourses of futurity. In my talk today, I'm going to trace how customer service work conducted by those occupying the lowest rungs of the BPO industry, namely call center agents, is entangled with processes of mobility and emplacement. I use the term mobility to include migration and movement across the city, as well as virtual and imaginative mobility. Furthermore, mobility and processes of communication are mutually imbricated. As I will argue shortly, the affective labor of my informants is contingent upon their connectivity with their clients, who are not only at great physical distance from them, but are also culturally and experientially remote. Their labor, then, depends on their ability to communicate affects of care and intimacy, and critically encapsulates linguistic as well as extra-linguistic forms of connectivity. Yet the world and work of call center agents also consists of moments of mistranslation, missed translations, partial translations, and opacity in their interactions with their clients. When this happens, my informants are put in place or put in their place, thus underscoring the co-implication of mobility and emplacement. My goal eventually is to explore how these processes of mobility, emplacement, and translation are crucial to the formation of affective sovereignties for subjects variably placed along axes of race, gender, and culture. As I conclude my fieldwork, the film Babel, which came out in 2006 and was directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu. How many of you have seen this film? Came out in 2006. Interesting film, right? Anyway, as I finish my research, this film is never far from my mind. Babel narrates four interlinked stories. It is about Abdullah, a poor Moroccan shepherd, and his family, whose lives are irreparably shattered when one of his young children accidentally shoots and injures Susan Jones, a wealthy white American tourist who is traveling through Morocco with her husband, Richard. It narrates what happens to Amelia, their Latina nanny, who takes their children to Mexico to attend her son's wedding, gets into trouble with U.S. immigration as she attempts to return home to San Diego, and is forced to, quote-unquote, self-deport. And last but not least, it is the story of Chieko, a hearing and speech-impaired schoolgirl in Tokyo whose yearning for emotional and social connection takes the form of sexual longing. She is the daughter of a wealthy Japanese businessman who, after traveling to Morocco, gifts a gun to his tour guide, who in turn sells it to Abdullah. So you can see the story looping back to Morocco in various ways and at various times throughout the film. This gun and the accidental shooting that ensues sets in motion the events that link together the four stories of the film. This slender diegetic thread notwithstanding, Babel is in fact about disconnections and disjunctures as much as it is about transnational connectivity. Its four stories are narrated in different languages and with sharply contrasting visual grammars. Each story is stylistically and aesthetically distinct in terms of music and cinematography, and these narrative techniques foreground the disjunctures that undermine the connections between them. Babel underscores how race and nationality shape the abilities of certain bodies to move freely while other bodies are put in place, often violently. It also underscores the fragility of communication in a world of transnational connectivity. Babel has been a good film for me to think with because it foregrounds some of the themes that have preoccupied me in my current research. In the world of our informants, affective labor blurs the line between labor and leisure and entails new forms of imagination, embodiment, and aspiration. These new forms of imagination and aspiration are inflected by our informants' sense of precarity, their acute feeling of vulnerability stemming from being emplaced in a global service industry stratified by race, gender, and national location. At the same time, the world of call centers is contingent on heterogeneous forms of mobility. In fact, our informants' ability to move across different borders, national, class, cultural, and experiential, forms the very basis of their affective labor. Thus, in this world, mobility, affective labor, and connectivity are co-implicated. I will argue today that mobility, emplacement, and connectivity are deeply imbricated with what I have termed affective sovereignty. I use the term sovereignty capaciously to encapsulate diverse, sometimes divergent scales and registers. On the one hand, globalization and transnationality are often deemed to bring national sovereignty to crisis while also engendering new forms of sovereignty, as for instance, in the conflation of autonomy and freedom in neoliberal discourses of individual sovereignty. Affect offers us a way to think of agential capacity in terms of temporality, and as neither trapped in the sterile binary of domination versus resistance, nor understood as rational or instrumental action. Some theorists of affect, most notably Brian Massumi, argue against considerations of positionality. However, I wish to underscore the co-implication of the affective and the social. And thus, and importantly, using the lens of affect enables us to diverge from thinking of sovereignty in either-or terms, as something we either have or do not have, and thereby eschew liberal notions of agency. Affect signals a capacity for moving through and being emplaced in worlds that are frequently not of our making. My aim, therefore, is to explore how rethinking sovereignty in terms of affect might enable us to track the generative capacity of transnational subjects, like my informants in Bangalore, to inhabit the world, and more crucially, to navigate it with resilience. Foregrounding resilience is critical to the conceptual and political interventions I seek to make. As I will argue below, resilience rather than resistance inflected the affective sovereignties of my informants in uneven and discontinuous ways. Seeking and seeing the resilience of my informants in the face of physical and emotional burnout and precarity seems to me to be particularly urgent at a moment when the neoliberal subsumption of life by capital is assumed to be imminent. Seeking and holding on to their resilience enables me to steer away from the violently reductive trap of narrating their lives in terms of a teleological narrative of the triumphal march of global capital. In this paper, I will argue that the capacity for mobility is deeply imbricated with sovereignty, be it the sovereignty of subjects or of nations. However, for many marginalized individuals and communities, mobility is conjoined with immobility, staying put, and feeling stuck. Mobility, immobility, and emplacement in the world of call centers. Babel helps explicate several themes that are salient in our ethnographic research. Most powerfully, it underscores the intersection of different scales of sovereignty, the sovereignty of nations, and the differentially experienced sovereignty of subjects. When Richard and Susan Jones travel across Morocco, they undergo experiences of danger to their lives and vulnerability, of profound dependence on each other and the goodwill of the Moroccan villagers who shelter them, and of the failure of language when Richard struggles to convey to Moroccan authorities the urgency of getting his wife to a hospital. And all of these experiences are transformative. The ability of the Joneses to be tourists to travel for pleasure is enabled by their race and their nationality, and contrasts sharply with the experiences of Amelia, who is interrogated at the U.S.-Mexico border and prohibited from returning to her home in San Diego. National sovereignty and personal sovereignty thus intersect as they shape the divergent mobilities of the Joneses and Amelia. Amelia is put in place, literally, by immigration officers. She is deported and has to return to Mexico, even though she has lived in the U.S. for many decades and has her home there. The mobility of capital and labor has been foundational to the business process outsourcing industry. Indeed, the name business process outsourcing refers to a range of long-distance services provided by Indian companies to corporations in countries like the United States, the UK, and Australia. Initially, data entry and data transcription projects, or processes as they are termed in the industry, were outsourced to India. Very quickly, the industry expanded to include customer service and the economies of big cities, some small towns, and the financial prospects of hundreds of thousands of young men and women in many parts of India took a new turn. In the initial years, labor arbitrage, which refers to the ability to pay workers in the global south lower wages, was a primary motivation for multinationals who set up shop in countries like India and the Philippines. Even today, an entry-level agent in a call center makes about one-tenth the minimum wage in California. As Gupta and I state elsewhere, call centers were first established to handle the communications component of customers' interactions with banks, airlines, taxi fleets, and the like. How many of you have been phoned just when you were sitting down to dinner by a customer service agent in another country? Most of you, I would imagine, right? So anyway, this is what life looks like from their point of view. The development of inexpensive and high-quality telecommunications infrastructure was critical in enabling such a move. Today, BPO work has diversified and ranges from back-end office work, such as the preparation of reports and PowerPoint presentations, to high-end support services, such as the reading of lab reports for hospitals and preparation of briefs for law firms. In fact, in the United States, the Internal Revenue Service, which is the main sort of tax and auditing service of the U.S. government, outsources a lot of its tax auditing to companies in India, which is an interesting irony. Knowledge process outsourcing has risen to prominence and, in fact, is now gradually being supplanted by the growth of analytics. This is an industry that is itself extremely mobile. It's always on the move in response to the search of global capital for higher profits, which in turn is enabled by lower wages and lower overhead costs. In addition, many multinational companies based in the West have now outsourced their HR operations to India, where Indian teams are tasked with the recruitment and management of employees in the West, another set of ironies. And also, even more ironically, devising strategies for downsizing the companies in the West. So you have Indian teams that are now tasked with the job of downsizing companies in the US. So this leads to, as you can imagine, a lot of anger and resentment. Although our fieldwork in Bangalore was in call centers and other kinds of BPOs, for the purposes of this talk, I will draw primarily on our observations and interviews with call center agents. Concerns about national sovereignty are fundamental to state policies on the BPO industry. As much as the growth of the outsourcing industry in the global south was engendered by shifts in the global economy from manufacturing to the service sector, the Indian state has directly participated and invested in the growth of the BPO industry. State investment in telecommunications infrastructure, tax breaks to multinational companies to launch BPOs, the establishment of industrial park and special economic zones, or SEZs, and other such policies became essential to the rise of the BPO industry. These state policies have been predicated on the belief that national sovereignty depends on the growth of the economy. The assumption is that a strong economy will result in a modern, developed, and sovereign Indian nation. In addition, as I have argued elsewhere, state policies have gone hand in hand with the hegemony of neoliberal discourses of entrepreneurship, risk, and individual growth, which have provided the ideological and discursive scaffolding for the growth of affective labor in the BPO industry. The growth of the outsourcing industry in India is fundamentally conjoined with discourses of national sovereignty on multiple and intersecting registers. As we learned through our fieldwork in Bangalore, the discursive conjunction between the growth of BPOs and national sovereignty was not restricted to government officials and politicians. In 2009, the government then in power was loudly proclaiming that India had arrived and was now poised to take its place on the global stage. This rhetoric was ubiquitous in the discourses of an overwhelming majority of our informants in Bangalore, ranging from angel investors and CEOs to data or entry operators and call center agents, all of whom firmly believed that the BPO industry was largely responsible for the growth of the Indian economy. Nor was the sense of national pride verbalized in discourses of emergent India confined to politicians and upper-class elites. In fact, it was echoed by almost all the call center agents that we interviewed, a majority of whom came from working-class families. For these informants, upward class mobility had come very quickly, and for almost all of them, their own upward mobility was closely related to the upward mobility of the nation, or what they saw as the upward mobility of the nation. Working in a call center offered them unprecedented opportunities for earning salaries that were inconceivable for previous generations. Their salaries and the emoluments they accrued benefited their entire families. However, apart from opportunities for personal growth and social mobility, it was the feeling that they were participating in the larger story of emergent India that was frequently articulated by our informants. As Rajat, a young man who had just started working in a BPO, insisted, and I quote, "BPOs have made India take its rightful place in the world. Now nobody can push us around," he said. Many of our informants felt that by working in BPOs, they were performing a crucial role in a drama much larger than their own upward mobility or that of their families. They felt strongly that their individual destinies were inseparable from the destiny of India. The rise of emergent India also meant that India could not be pushed around, not by rich countries and certainly not by neighbors like Pakistan or China, with whom India has fought major wars since independence. In these discourses, BPOs were directly responsible for not just the economic progress of India, but equally significantly a surge in nationalist pride, which in turn frequently slid into xenophobia. In the United States, the outsourcing of knowledge economy jobs to the global south, particularly to India and the Philippines, has produced nationalist discourses of a very different kind. Here, outsourcing has unleashed its own versions of xenophobia. It is important to recall that controversies surrounding the outsourcing of jobs to India partake of a longer genealogy of racialized and racist discourses about the relationship between labor, high technology, and Asia and Asians. Located as they are within a global political economy that is triated by race as much as it is by gender and national location, call center agents in India are always already racialized by virtue of working in this industry. This has had consequences for the affective sovereignties of my informants in Bangalore, who engaged in distinct practices of mobility, even as they were emplaced in particular ways because of their race, national location, and particularly in the case of women, their gender. The lives and worlds of the call center agents with whom we worked were predicated upon mobility, the mobility of capital, and in very different ways of labor to move across national borders. Certainly, the BPO industry depends on the differentiated mobilities of its workers. First and most obviously, it depends on the ability of young men and women to move across the city, often across the country, to work in call centers. However, because they had to follow the schedules of clients overseas, most of our informants worked at night when their customers were awake. In order to engage in night work, our informants had to travel across the city while their families and neighbors were asleep. Many of our informants complained that the demands of working at night had far-reaching consequences for their health and their social lives. Their spatial mobility entailed temporal dislocation, which for many resulted in what A. Anish has called social death. As one of our informants put it, she felt out of sync with the rest of Bangalore, and particularly with her family and friends, because she frequently had to work the night shift. Spatiality and temporality are neither gender neutral nor immune to hegemonic discourses of race, class, and in the case of my informants, national location. Geographers like Doreen Massey have long commented on how the mobility and immobility of women foregrounds how spaces are fundamentally gendered. Although for both our men and women informants, physical mobility, their ability to traverse the city to do night work, was a prerequisite for working in call centers, gender deeply impacted their capacity to navigate space and time. Traveling across the city to do night work was particularly difficult for young women for various reasons. For one, doing night work and having to travel to work at night was often viewed with suspicion by neighbors, community members, and family members who subjected these women to intense surveillance. Social stigma attached to women who did night work, and this had tangible consequences. Sometimes, landlords would refuse to rent apartments to women who worked in call centers because they were deemed to be promiscuous or have loose characters. Then there were the very real dangers of sexual violence that these women faced by traveling across the city at night. These dangers and the stigma attached to women who did night work were so acute that all the companies that we worked with provided cabs or vans that transported their employees to and from work. As a result, companies maintained detailed logs of when and where women employees were picked up and dropped off. While these practices were ostensibly for the protection of women, like many protectionist discourses, they resulted in the intensification of their monitoring and surveillance. The women we worked with frequently worried aloud about the dangers they faced, not just from strangers, but also from cab drivers and colleagues. Their fears were accentuated after the widely publicized Pratibha Murthy case in Bangalore, who was raped by a man posing as a company-employed driver. Furthermore, women who had migrated to Bangalore from other parts of India, especially from the northeastern states, felt extremely vulnerable to sexual violence. More generally, women call center agents were frequently regarded as promiscuous or loose, precisely because of their ability to move across distances, whether across the city at night or from other parts of the country. Once again, discourses of gender, sexuality, and in the case of women who appeared visibly other, race, served to emplace these women in distinct ways. Most of these women worked in call centers because these jobs offered them opportunities for class mobility that were unavailable in their hometowns or through other avenues of work. The fact that they showed up to work when the rest of the city was asleep, braving the risks of traveling across a suspicious and hostile city, was testimony as much to their resilience as to their struggles for upward mobility. Most of our informants hailed from working class backgrounds, and working in call centers meant that not only they, but their entire extended families experienced class mobility. Thus, mobility was indispensable to their livelihood and the financial well-being of entire families. At the same time, it is also important for me to note that some of our women informants, despite being scared of going out at night, use their work as a means to visit bars and pubs and to socialize after work. Thus, working in call centers enabled these women to venture into spaces that, despite being dangerous, were full of enticement. And here I want to caution about sort of falling into the liberal trap of thinking of these women as exercising choice or freedom. It's surely much more complicated than that. It's important to note that while our informants' labor moved across national borders, they themselves had to stay put. It bears remembering that the expansion of outsourcing to the global south was a direct result of restrictions on the import of foreign laborers to many advanced capitalist countries. In the United States, for example, software companies began to outsource to India when increasing restrictions were placed on their ability to offer H-1B visas to engineers from India and other countries in the global south. The outsourcing of software opened the door to the outsourcing of customer service and back office work to companies in India and the Philippines. Yet, these laboring bodies had to stay put because of their race, class, and nationality. Capital required the fruit of their labor, but nationalist and xenophobic immigration restrictions made it impossible for them to live in these countries while they worked, thus resulting in particular forms of emplacement. Several of our informants, especially those who'd been working in call centers for a decade, frequently complained of feeling stuck. The relentless rhythms of their schedules, the intense pressure of meeting quotas at work, the racial abuse meted out to them by customers overseas, who resented the fact that they were speaking to service providers in India, the surveillance of neighbors and employers alike, all took a toll on their bodies and emotions. There was no question that they had attained social mobility. They were now earning salaries that no one in their families had ever earned or even imagined. And as noted above, entire families benefited from their earnings. And I cannot emphasize this enough. Sometimes a single call center agent would support an extended family, would support half the village. So there's a kind of ripple effects of this work that we cannot underestimate. Even so, many of them felt burnt out or stuck in place. Almost all of them had entered the world of call centers in their late teens or early 20s, and now that they were approaching their 30s, they felt they could not go on. They were exhausted. Yet they felt they had no other prospects. And in fact, many of our informants who had left call center jobs because they were burnt out returned to them, either because they could not find jobs that paid them as well, or because they missed the buzz and the excitement of working there. Those who had some knowledge of the relationship between call centers and the world of multinational capital were particularly sensitive to how their jobs were contingent on the predatory irrationalities of global capital. They were acutely aware that they were being paid considerably less than workers in advanced capitalist countries who did comparable work, and deeply resented that their employers were profiting from their low wages. For these informants, the feeling of being stuck rankled very deeply. They felt trapped in their cubicles, in their jobs, and in their lives. Gendered and racialized formations of spatiality and temporality, then, profoundly shaped our informants' abilities to be mobile and to navigate the worlds in which they found themselves. These capacities to be mobile were circumscribed by their location in a global service industry that is sharply stratified by race, national location, and gender. Their mobility, therefore, went hand in hand with processes of emplacement. This sense of feeling stuck in an industry all too closely attuned to the vicissitudes of global capitalism, the claustrophobia induced by multiple modes of surveillance to which they were subjected, and the political economies of race and class that resulted in the fact that while their labor crossed national borders, they had to stay put in their cubicles in India. This section is called Translation and the Inequality of Languages, Cultural and Experiential Border Crossing. Babel exposes the myth of seamless communication in a world of transnational connectivities. Richard Jones fails to get his wife to a hospital in Morocco, and Amelia struggles in vain to explain to the border patrol officer that she is responsible for the white children in her charge. The failure of language is most explicitly narrated in the story of Chieko, who struggles to form connections with the boy that she wants to befriend, the police officer who comes to interview her father, and most poignantly, her father after her mother's suicide. The trailer for the film states, "No one is listening." However, the title of the film, Babel, alludes to the biblical story of the hubris of humans who try to create a language that will enable them to directly communicate with God. As punishment, God condemns them to confusion. Instead of having a single language, they now have multiple languages, all of which are mutually incomprehensible. The call center industry has, from its inception, been predicated on the belief that a combination of quote-unquote trainable labor and technology will enable the bridging of physical and cultural distances between call center agents and their customers. Connectivity is assumed to produce certain forms of imaginative travel and mobility. Call centers are, of course, all about connecting linguistically and, importantly, affectively. Indian workers are trained to speak the language of their customers with the expectation that once they learn the right dialects of English, assume the correct accents, and adopt relevant speech patterns, they can effortlessly communicate with customers who are not only at a physical distance, but are also distanced by culture and experience. Thus, as I will argue below, the world and work of call center agents is predicated not simply on the transmission of information, as technocratic accounts of the BPO industry will have us believe, but on processes of translation. Susan Gall defines linguistic translation as, quote, a family of semiotic processes that change the form, the social place, or the meaning of a text, object, person, or practice, while simultaneously seeming to keep something about it the same, unquote. Moving away from a Euro-American common sense understanding of translation as a faithful reproduction of the original, Gall foregrounds its linguistic, ontological, and social productivity. She adds, quote, communicative practices create equivalences and organize connections between practices. Such practices also create incommensurability, disjunctures, and power differentials, unquote. I wish to foreground that just as linguistic translation is never a seamless transfer, the technological production of seamless connectivity is also a myth. To reiterate, by translation, I refer not simply to linguistic practices, although those are critical to voice processing, but also to extra-linguistic forms of communication that involve affect. As noted above, for my informants, the affective labor of customer service work entailed processes of imaginative and cultural border crossing and the production of empathy, and empathy is a word you hear a lot in the trainings of call center agents, in their recruitment. They're always being instructed to feel empathy, to create empathy in their work with their clients. In these contexts, communication and translation involve processes of interpretation that were fundamentally contingent as they occurred across contexts of inequality and power. Here I draw upon Talal Asad's theorization of the inequality of languages to underscore the way in which languages, quite literally, are hierarchically positioned in the current global economy. Thus, in the world of call centers, a hegemonic version of quote-unquote global English is deemed indispensable to participating in the global economy, while versions of English shaped, for instance, by regional accents, or what in the call center industry is dismissed as MTI, or mother tongue influence. This is, again, an acronym that we hear very often. When people are turned down for a job, we are told that it's because that person's MTI was too strong. In other words, the influence of their mother tongue on their English was too strong, and therefore they were disqualified. As Gall points out, post-colonial scholarship has challenged notions of translation as unmediated and transparent representation to focus instead on the asymmetrical practices that produce subaltern subjects. In the field of anthropology, scholars at the forefront of the reflexive turn in the 1980s analyzed how inequalities arising from colonialism and from asymmetries in the global political economy have shaped how ethnographers practice their craft. Excuse me. For instance, again, I refer to Talal Asad's wonderful work on the critique of British social anthropology and its project of cultural translation, whereby native categories are analyzed in terms of categories of colonial anthropology. Analogous asymmetries shaped interactions between our informants and their clients. In the processes of interpretation and translation that occurred during customer service work, it was not simply language, accents, dialects, and turns of phrase that were rendered unequal. Given that our informants' labor was directed to satisfying customers located in the global north, it were experiences and modes of being in the world that were placed in hierarchical relations with one another. The onus of doing the work of cultural and experiential translation was placed on workers in the global south. Any ensuing misunderstandings, mistranslations, or partial translations were deemed markers of these agents' failure. These alleged failures on the part of agents had material consequences that ranged from being passed up for promotion or being demoted or even being fired. In these instances, agents who were always already racialized through their national locations often also faced racist abuse from their customers in the global north. While doing fieldwork in call centers, we frequently attended interviews and training sessions during which concerns about hiring trainable workers dominated all discussions of the criteria employers could use to select agents. The most important questions recruiters asked themselves were all related to the ability of potential agents to connect with overseas customers. How strong was the MTI, or mother tongue, influence on their speech? Would they be able to train the agent to shed the last residue of the language he or she grew up with and adopt a quote-unquote neutral accent? Could the potential recruit be trained to be attuned to the needs of customers for a different culture and respond appropriately in their interactions with them? Could the young person be schooled to communicate with a customer who lived in a world at great remove from him or her? If language was deemed to be a means to travel across vast cultural and experiential distances and was to this extent directly related to the capacity to be mobile, agents' interactions with clients extended beyond language to affective engagement. Thus, for our informants, the ability to successfully connect with the clients entailed not simply language training or the transmission of information, but more fundamentally, processes of cultural and experiential translation. It constituted a crucial modality of affective labor predicated on their capacity to traverse experiential and cultural borders in order to engage with clients with empathy. Indeed, the affective labor of call center agents depended on their ability to make connections with customers that they would never meet face to face. Yet, like the babel of untranslatable languages in Iñárritu's film, the call center agents with whom we worked occasionally also confronted the incomprehensibility of experiences and life worlds as they performed their affective labor. These moments of miscommunication and opacity and the mistranslations that they engendered only served to make my informants feel that they were being put in their place. These instances foregrounded not simply the instability of meaning, but also how miscommunication and opacity resulted in processes of emplacement for our informants. Our informants came from a diverse range of backgrounds. Some had spent most of their lives in villages and small towns and were now in a metropolis for the first time in their lives. Even those who had lived in big cities had spent most of their lives in poor neighborhoods. Several had grown up on the cusp of poverty. Yet, they were expected to feel a connection with their first world clients after receiving a week or two of cultural training. Once on the shop floor, as I was listening in on calls, I sat alongside a young man who had grown up in a semi-rural periphery of Bangalore. He spoke in an Australian accent to a client about the weather in Sydney, made small talk with him about the last footy match, and then proceeded to try to sell him a cruise to the Caribbean. I do not know if he was actually successful in selling him the cruise, but sitting by him, I marveled at his ability to traverse cultural and experiential boundaries in his interaction with this client. However, some of our other informants found themselves in situations where they could not connect with their clients. No amount of language or cultural training could help because their own life worlds were so different as to be at a remove from these clients. On multiple registers, then, mobility was fundamental to our informants' ability to do their work and to their formation as laboring subjects. As noted above, their social mobility depended on their physical mobility and additionally on what Reena Patel has called temporal mobility. But their affective labor was also contingent on their imaginative mobility. In the early years of the BPO industry, call centers were instructed to assume foreign names and personas and thus engage in practices of impersonation. They had to learn to become someone else. Although this practice has fallen over the years, most of our informants had to reconstitute their identities in ways that went beyond simply assuming new names, accents, or personas. As Gupta and I have argued elsewhere, the affective labor of our informants involved new modes of embodiment and new ways of inhabiting and navigating the world. In order to relate to customers who live in a different world, our informants had to imaginatively travel there to be able to relate to them, perform customer service, answer their questions, and sometimes serve as their informal therapists or become their confidants. They had to engage in cultural border crossing, and additionally, because they were expected to display empathy, had to engage in experiential border crossing. Not all of our informants were always successful in performing these emotional and experiential journeys or migrations. In these instances, differences in class, race, and culture became insurmountable obstacles and created moments of opacity, mistranslation, or incomprehensibility, much like the confusion of languages in the biblical story of Babel. Let me explain with an ethnographic example. Vandana was a young woman in her early 20s who had been working as a call center agent for close to 5 years. She was never promoted to supervisor because, in her words, she had messed up, these are her words, with one of her clients when she had first started working as a call center agent. One night, she and I sat in the company cafe and started to chat over our coffees. And Vandana narrated to me how she had been taken off a very prestigious debt collection process with a multinational credit card company because she could not bring herself to be tactful or empathetic to a customer, a middle-aged woman who lived in the United Kingdom. This happened at a time when call centers had become more concerned about their customer satisfaction index, or CSI, than the number of calls agents could make during their shifts. At stake, then, was the agent's ability to connect with customers and gently nudge them to pay off their debts. Although agents had to ensure that they followed a protocol, going off script was not actively discouraged as long as they met their goals. Vandana had made several calls to this woman, coaxing her to pay her debt, but to no avail. For this was a woman who, after her retirement, had made a hobby of going on cruises several times a year. The only problem with that was that she had put these expenses on her credit card and had quickly amassed huge debt, which she was unable to pay off. It then fell to Vandana's lot to get her to pay up. Vandana called her several times and finally lost her patience. This was a real no-no for a customer service agent, but it was incomprehensible to her that her client could build up debts by going on cruises. Vandana had once seen her father take out a loan with tremendous trepidation when her younger brother had needed an operation. She had also heard of relatives who, in sheer desperation, had taken loans when their crops had failed. But to amass such huge debts to go on cruises was something she could never understand. This was a world that made no sense to her. She shook her head in bewilderment as she recounted what had happened. Enraged by her impatience with her, her client complained to the credit card company, which in turn threatened to withdraw the contract from the call center. Call centers are part of the information technology-enabled services industry, the ITES industry, as the acronym suggests. Information technology is assumed to enable the provision of services across vast physical, social, and cultural distance, and to make movement across these boundaries not just possible, but seamless. The success of these firms is based on the premise that workers in the Global South can be trained to engage in these forms of boundary crossing. The assumption is that information technology can help them to do precisely that. Certainly, our informants' worlds were marked by dense connectivity as they spent hours, day after day, speaking with customers in a different place and time. As noted above, their labor and very livelihoods depended on their ability to make a connection, sometimes an intimate connection, with strangers who they would never meet. Yet Vandana was not alone in bumping up against these moments of mistranslation. Other informants also discussed with us the times when they were unable to relate to their clients and were therefore ineffective at performing the affective labor that was expected of them. To conclude then, historically, the movement of people has always been regulated, whether it was through the trade routes or at its most violent extreme, the forced movement of people in slavery and indenture. Then, as now, the mobility of individuals and communities across transnational space often occurs in contexts of coercion and at times of violence. The movement of people continues to be regulated, whether through immigration policy, checkpoints, or border control. The film Babel depicts multiple forms of border crossing, including the mobility and immobility of subjects differentially positioned along axes of race, class, and ability across national as well as experiential borders. The world of call center agents is hardly analogous to what we see in Babel. Nevertheless, this is a world that assumes multiple forms of border crossing, not all of which are successful. My goal has been to map the intersection of the macropolitics of global capital, transnational labor regimes, and hegemonic discourses of race and gender with the micro practices of movement and emplacement among my informants in Bangalore. I've tried to engage how mobility, being put in place, and feeling stuck are mutually imbricated with profound implications for the production of affective sovereignties. As Karen Kaplan has noted, in context of high-tech capitalism, the self is not released from a national location, but very much emplaced within it. For my informants, staying put was not a choice, but a source of vulnerability and very often claustrophobia. For many, it led to an intense sense of feeling stuck. Babel exposes the myth of seamless communication in a world of transnational connectivities. The call center industry has, from its inception, been predicated on the belief that a combination of trainable labor and technology will enable the bridging of physical and cultural distances between call center agents and their customers. Communication is assumed to produce certain forms of imaginative travel and mobility. Certainly, the affective labor of call center agents is based on their ability to make connections with customers that they will never meet face to face. Gall points to the dangers of reifying differences between languages by overemphasizing incommensurability. Certainly, as anthropologists have long pointed out, neither languages nor cultures are bounded systems, but are in fact produced through encounters across difference. At the same time, nor do these encounters lead to seamless connectivity, and this is where the film Babel is instructive. Babel makes us query what translation might mean in the context of the transnational circulation of capital, labor, and images. On the one hand, The film urges us to recognize the fragility of connectivity and, in particular, the failure of a common language. Instead of English being a mode of connection in the film, it produces disconnections and misconnections. The relationship between linguistic failure and translation lies at the heart of the film and subverts the notion of a seamless flow of communication in a transnational world. But on the other hand, at issue here is not simply linguistic translation, but also cultural translation and the commensurability of experience. Babel portrays the gaps, frictions, and disruptions that belie the myth of seamless connectivity while simultaneously foregrounding how meanings are produced across difference in such a way as to reinforce, if not exacerbate, relationships of asymmetry and inequality. Indeed, it might be helpful to interpret the mistranslations and partial translations in the world of call centers as productive of meaning-making rather than failure. Thus conceived, translations and mistranslations are generative articulations in every sense of the term. For the call center agents that we worked with, the centrality of technology to their lives and worlds has led to some interesting apparent paradoxes. As we have argued elsewhere, their labor is affective but not immaterial. Their labor might appear to be disembodied, yet is enabled by processes of profound re-embodiment when they learn to inhabit their world, their bodies, in tandem with the work discipline of their work. Most pertinent to my argument in this talk, these apparent paradoxes also include the hyperbole of unlimited mobility and the claim that technology has rendered national borders obsolete versus the intensity with which call center agents feel stuck or put in place. Then there is the apparent paradox of their ability to communicate across vast distances and to this extent engage in imaginative and cultural travel versus their confrontation with moments of opacity and untranslatability. The world of call centers is contingent on the speed of the transmission of labor and of information. At the same time, technologies of surveillance and immigration policies track and fix agents' bodies in place. The optic of affective sovereignties enables us to trace how for call center agents, movement, mobility, staying in place, and feeling stuck are new modalities of new forms of mobility in a transnational world. That's it for now. I'm happy to take questions from all of you. Thank you.